This is a talk about the problem of feeding infants in very poor countries. The conference and the session is mostly about U.S. issues. But even if you're not motivated by the question itself, which I think is fascinating and, of course, of enormous importance for human welfare, the remedy that we're looking at is, I think, gives us a really interesting x-ray into what's behind food markets in the U.S. as well. So the basic idea is that the market is what's sick. The market is what's having an institutional illness, if you will, that we do know something about how to diagnose and how to remedy through the tools of economics that you'll see here, through this instrument of quality certification. So like others, like most people at the conference, I have no financial relationships with commercial interests. The problem that this addresses, as you might know, is that the vast bulk of the world's undernutrition happens in this very short window of time between about 3 months of age, when some children begin to have growth faltering, and about 24 months of age when that growth faltering ends. So the red line shows you children's weight for height on average, as far as global surveys are able to tell. Children are born at a reasonable weight for height, the average of the World Health Organization norms. The green line shows weight for age, slightly below, and the reason is that the blue line, the height for age, children start a little below in height for age at birth and through the first 2-3 months, but then begin to falter, and what you see, the faltering patterns are very similar in timing, and they end at about 24 months. So that's the puzzle here. The answer to explanation for the puzzle is illustrated in part by this second chart that shows how the timing is the same across regions. So this is in terms of height for age, that is the degree of stunting. Very little initial stunting at 0 to 3 months, then it gets much worse, stops at 24. And if you look at weight for height, wasting, children getting suddenly thinner, that happens only in the poorest countries. So in the green line is Asia, the orange line is Africa, and you see that children fall off a cliff at about 4 months of age in terms of weight, suddenly becoming very, very thin. That's the onset of a lot of morbidity, mortality, and then ends abruptly. The worsening stops. There's some catch that catches children as they fall off that cliff in that early infancy period. So there's a whole lot of stuff behind this, right? It could be suddenly exposure to waterborne pathogens, exposure to indoor air pollution. If you've been in kitchens in very poor countries, there's a wood fire that is extremely costly in upper respiratory illness and infection. And of course, expression of earlier deficits, epigenetic phenomena and so forth could be what's going on. But these data and many others show you that there's also simply not enough food. There is not enough food, not enough total calories. This is essentially the only population in the world for whom that is the central problem of undernutrition. It's absolutely extraordinary. And it's all the more extraordinary because the total quantity of food that infants need is so small. And the cost of that, even in the world's poorest households, is very small compared to the costs of feeding adults and other costs in the household. But the foods required are unique to children of that age. As you would know from your, you know, nutritional life cycle classes and or even experience with, you know, one's own children, you're looking at needing foods that are of much higher nutrient density and higher digestibility than those that even an older child would eat after about 2 years of age. So what's that about? It's about having foods that have some high-cost ingredients and some high-cost processing. This gets exactly at George's paper, in the sense that you need a starchy staple that has to be fortified with protein, fats, and micronutrients. This is the thrifty food plan, but writ small, if you will, for an infant. And that's possible to do at home using traditional methods. Every great-great-grandmother knew how to do it in ancestral time for every culture in the world, whether it's Asia, Africa, Latin America, or our own ancestors, wherever they may have been from. People knew exactly how to feed infants. The only problem was it took a hellacious amount of time. because you had to do it four or five times a day. You had to mix up the high-cost animal source protein products with apologies. It is possible, of course, to do this with plant-based foods, but all the more labor-intensive if your sources are legumes and so forth. And the basic problem here is that labor cost-saving availability from artisanal or industrial manufacturers is limited. So this is about that. And if you're involved at all in infant nutrition in the world, you'd know that this was one of the earliest questions addressed by nutrition scholars in developing countries. So Incaparina is the iconic product introduced in the early 1960s in Guatemala. Donors have noticed this forever and have funded startups to produce and sell high-quality complementary foods all over the world. You can't go to any low-income country and not find a donor-funded startup doing infant feeding. Now, what's interesting about this is that when you go to those developing countries, as I just mentioned, you see the donor-funded startup. What products do you actually see in the marketplace? If you get out of the airport, virtually any low-income country, you see something like this. This is Accra in Ghana. So this is the brand. This is the Starbucks of infant food, infant feeding in the developing world. It's a single iconic brand. It's manufactured, of course, by Nestle, a multinational. That tin you see on the left-hand side of the screen is at Tetekwarshi Circle in Accra. It's the most visible landmark, essentially, in the city. It's been there for decades. And the billboard that you see on the right is ubiquitous all across Africa. There are, as I mentioned, many, many alternatives. So this is in Ghana, marketed under the term Weenie Mix, a woman selling this stuff in the market in little sachets. These are small-scale local startups all around Africa. There's also multinational competitors, Nestle's wannabes trying to compete with Nestle's. I'm describing a long research program that began about 13 years ago with this survey in Mali, showing the packagings and pricings of products available. What you see is the branded products, the variants of Cerelac, followed by Bledilac, a Swiss company, and Farinor, which is actually a multinational, but it's based in Africa. And this much, much cheaper set of products at the bottom, Yucadal and Misola, that are donor-funded startups. The donor-funded startups, you really have to hunt to find them. You can find them if you know where you're looking, but they're not available very widely. When I went to Ghana last year to do a follow-up study, this is, you know, what I could find, an enormous variety. So the puzzle is, why do you see only the dominant branded product when the cheaper substitutes absolutely do exist? They just are hard to find. Possible explanation? Maybe mothers just don't know much about it. But that's hard to explain over decades and decades, and similarly across countries, country after country after country. Maybe it's that people know that the cheaper product is available, but they choose to signal status. Again, can't explain why the very poorest households would do this. Maybe there's this other thing, though, where the heavily advertised multinational brand name gives people confidence in the product. This is, in fact, a Nobel Prize-winning idea in economics. George Davis just mentioned the other Nobel Prize-winning idea about time. This one is about quality, and this is what we're applying. So the concept is that if buyers can't see the qualities, they know the qualities are desirable, but they can't see them in the product, then no matter how cheaply you sell a generic, I might think or fear that that generic has even less in it than I am paying. So I won't pay 50 cents because maybe it'll have 49 cents worth of ingredients, and I won't pay 49 cents because then it would have 48 cents worth of ingredients, and I won't pay 48 cents because then it might have 47 cents worth of ingredients, and on down to zero, I will pay zero for the no-name generic. And the no-name generic might be offered by a donor-funded startup, and the donor-funded startup would have that product in the marketplace, and whatever its actual ingredients are, I won't pay 50 because it might have 49. I won't pay 49 because it might have 48. I won't pay 48 because it might have 47. And on down to zero, I won't pay anything for it because I have no reason to trust it. And that mechanism is called the market for lemons in economics jargon. And it means buyers will only trust a product that is supported by advertising and a brand name. You will only buy it if you see the Super Bowl ad for it. You will only buy it if it has a puzzlingly high price that paradoxically is what gives you confidence. And that is a theory that could possibly explain this in a very persistent way. So that's what we have investigated in this research program. And the only remedy for that is to have a third quality third party do the testing and certification. So we have a set of experiments in Mali that compare people's purchases. We use experiments in the marketplace. This is a photograph of the woman choosing between these products. And we find that certification, information about quality, is worth as much to people as processing. This is really stunning, right? So in French, CFA francs, willing to pay almost as much just for the information about it as they are for the processing. We estimate the cost of certification and find that it would be very worthwhile. Many years later, got funding again to look at this in Ghana, asking, are they available and are they of high quality? What we find, answers are unambiguously no. They exist but are not available. I did a survey using Google Maps to define regions of the city and showed this result, that in each arbitrarily defined region of the city, what you see are shops have toothpaste and soap, and they have Cerelac, but they often do not have any other infant food. They don't bother to stock the thing that people don't buy because they don't know what's in it. And testing the actual quality, which of course householders cannot do for themselves, doing a standard proximates to find nutrient profiles, we find that many of them are in fact not nearly what they set out to be at the start. Did a similar study with, the results were surprising. I knew where these samples came from because I went and found the manufacturer, and often a very good-looking manufacturer had really lousy products. And a very householdy artisanal manufacturer had very good products. I did the same thing in Uganda, found again very, very low quality, and quality that in Uganda people had started putting nutrient facts labels on their products, imitating the U.S. ones, not mandated by law, but free to imitate U.S. nutrient facts labels. And the content of the products had no relationship to the claimed nutrient facts labels. In the absence of actually testing, actually paying a FDA inspector to go and test it, you will not see compliance. So, what we have is a straightforward story of a market being broken in which people, doing the best they can, are unable to come to a reasonable outcome of a low-cost generic that could happen, not happening. Even though it's possible to make them well, they're not often made well, and they're not available even when they are. With certification, you would have a much, much better outcome, and the reason why we know that is because we've seen certification introduced to many markets around the world, just not yet this one. We do observe this persisting over time. Why is it that governments don't get it together to do certification? Why aren't people in the streets demanding certification? Why isn't the Public Health Association in these countries demanding certification? Well, well-off people can buy enough of this of Cerelac. It's such small quantities to feed an infant. Potential beneficiaries have no idea what they're missing. How could you? Where there is demand for certification, it arises to address problems of contamination and toxins. This has nothing to do with toxins or contamination. This just has to do with high-cost ingredients being blended in a high-cost or labor-intensive way. So the market's stuck. And this is an example of a diagnosis and remedy that comes from social science, that comes from a certain amount of nutrition knowledge applied to a market to identify what it is that's missing and what the institutional arrangements are able or not able to provide. And I think even if you're not interested in the problem of infant feeding as such for developing countries, this is an amazing case study to think about what underlies the successes and the limited successes we've seen in the U.S. or other industrialized countries. Thanks very much.